So basically, what we have here is a bunch of army intelligence agents, as it appears, certainly are military personnel being infiltrated into Dallas, Texas, while being mustered out of the military, ostensibly, through an organization CUSA, or Conservatism USA, which then merges with, apparently here, the John Birch Society and Young Americans for Freedom. And again, consider the Nazi Party as a front for German military intelligence and as a vehicle for introducing the German army into civilian society, and consider also the Freikorps and the Black Reichswehr, also basically formed by the German army in order to eliminate political opponents. The rest of the broadcast, we're basically going to be discussing what we feel are, we obviously feel that the Kennedy assassination was a military coup, and again, this is hardly an original thesis with us. What we're going to be looking at are some indications that basically the assassination for President Kennedy was in the works a lot long, for a much longer period of time than most people would be inclined to think, even most people who have studied it. Consider the situation now in 1960. The Democrats had held the White House for 20 years, from 1932, when Hoover was defeated by Roosevelt, until 1952, when Eisenhower defeated Adlai Stevenson. Then Eisenhower holds the White House for 8 years, and then the Republicans find themselves with a situation where they may again be put out of the White House for a long time. And again, the candidacy of John Kennedy appeared certain at this point, and his only possible rival was LBJ, and it was not believed that by most people that LBJ would get the nomination. Of course, LBJ would not have been distasteful to the military and the conservatives in general. And what we're asking here is whether, in 1960, the Republicans, the conservative forces, we should say, we should not say the Republicans, because although there were some prominent members of the Republican Party, it was not a party assassination by any means. It was basically a military and intelligence coup. Now, what we're asking here, basically, is whether, before the 1960 election, the people that killed President Kennedy and overthrew the government of the United States were already taking steps to do just that, and there are indications that the assassination was in the works before 1960. I'm going to read you now from the fourth volume of an excellent set of books published by one of the most influential and prolific of all of the researchers into the Kennedy assassination. That guy is the editor of the Midlothian Mirror in Midlothian, Texas. His name is Penn Jones, Jr. Penn is P-E-N-N, just like in Penn Central. And he published his he publishes a newsletter called The Continuing Inquiry. He also published a four-volume series called Forgive My Grief. And in Forgive My Grief, Volume 4, and these books, by the way, are largely compilations of articles and editorials from the Midlothian Mirror, there is an article called Prior Planning, dated August 29th, 1974. And again, we're asking you to consider the assassination of Kennedy as a military coup. In 1959, three American men defected to the Soviet Union. A man named Riccardelli, Robert Edward Webster, and Lee Harvey Oswald, and all three returned to the United States in 1962. Katya Ford, K-A-T-Y-A-F-O-R-D, testified that when she asked Marina Oswald what caused Lee to go to Russia, Marina said Lee went to the Soviet Union for the RAND Corporation to help set up the American exhibit at the World Trade Exposition in Moscow. That was not the official version of why he went to Russia, by the way. Continuing with Jones' account. Obviously, Marina had her defectors, unquote, confused. RAND Corporation was the cover story used by Robert Edward Webster, another of the defectors. Were the masterminds behind the John Kennedy assassination preparing three potential patsies, two as backup in the event one failed to perform as directed? Did the stars ordain the 1959 defections and the 1962 repatriations, or was prior planning for the killing of Kennedy really going on in 1959? And again, ask yourself, if there was no connection between these defections, what the odds are that Marina would come up with a cover story for another one of these three defectors leaving in 59, coming back in 1962. Okay, continuing here with some indications, and admittedly these are sort of speculative, but these are some of the things which indicate, the greatest indication of the power behind the Kennedy assassination was their ability to control all elements of the national security establishment and the press. We looked at that in our Guns of November program number 2. And one of the things we're looking at right now are indications that the military was involved in this assassination, obviously, and also that basically the things were in the works in a much, much bigger way than even most students of the assassination tend to think. Again, quoting from Forgive My Grief, Volume 4. If one were going to take over a nation by assassination, it would be desirable to have a mobile, ready military force to throw into action anywhere in the nation if trouble developed. This is exactly the precaution taken by the military powers of the United States on November 22nd, 1963.
1 month prior to the assassination of President John Kennedy, the largest peacetime airlift in our history took place. Operation Big Lift moved an entire combat division from Texas to Germany for 30 days intensive training. On the day President Kennedy was killed, the last third of the returning troops was in the air over the United States at the time of the shooting in Dallas. Here was a combat force estimated to be a brigade combat team in the air with armed with personal weapons which could have been deployed into action anywhere in the nation on very short notice. Just another happenstance? Well, of course, many people have questioned whether that could be a happenstance, and one of the things that to consider is, well, as a student of the assassination, one quickly discovers that there were contingency plans galore, that the authorities were planning to, they had a number of different contingency plans available should the official version begin to unravel. One scenario that's been advanced in, by researchers in connection with this Operation Big Lift was that had things begun to unravel in Wallace or Dallas or Washington, basically people would have been told that either right-wing extremists, Castro agents, anti-Castro Cubans, or perhaps mafiosi had killed the president and perhaps were raising the devil in one way or another, and that the troops would be sent in. Of course, the bumps in the official story would then be smoothed out and the public would be presented with a fait accompli. But the troops being used to quell, you know, a group of Castroites who, upon whom the assassination would be blamed or something like that is the usual scenario that people feel would have involved these troops if indeed these troops and this airlift to Germany was part of the assassination plot. And most people have felt that there was an extreme contingency. In other words, that the authorities who performed the assassination were ready for a total unraveling and that these troops were the stopgap measure if the assassination attempt unraveled completely. Either Dallas or Washington or some other city would have been totally sealed off to the press and the public until an official version could be concocted. Now, one of the things that's so interesting about this is to coordinate this Operation Big Lift with a combat, an airlift of a combat-ready division from Texas to Germany, with the movement of Army personnel not only from Munich, Germany to Dallas to participate in the assassination, but moving from the military into civilian society, just as the Nazi Party permitted the Reichswehr to do, just as the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr were basically civilian underground extensions of the military. Now, obviously, an operation of this kind would have involved the coordination of NATO forces and so forth, and one of the interesting things to think about in connection with this particular aspect of the assassination, in connection with the wishbone or tuning fork configuration that we're suggesting to you of fascism in Germany and America being controlled by the same forces, and in connection with the constitutional confrontation, consider who was basically in charge of NATO at that time. Niptuck's going to tell you in just a second about a guy named General Adolf Heusinger. He was the top NATO military officer, and he was installed in the Pentagon. Nip is going to tell you about him. Remember, as he's telling you about Adolf Heusinger, that the chief of operations and plans for the chief of staff of the Army at this point was a mysterious German named Fritz Kramer. Exactly who Fritz Kramer is a subject of mystery and contention. There is a growing body of circumstantial evidence, however, which suggests that this Fritz Kramer may, in fact, be the Fritz Kramer who served as the chief of staff for the 6th SS Panzer Army, one of Hitler's top shock units during World War II. That is obviously still in the investigative stage, probably will never be resolved for certain, but there is a number of elements of circumstantial evidence pointing very strongly in that direction, and updates on that tune in May Brussels World Watchers broadcast. But the chief of plans for the Army is this mysterious German Fritz Kramer. Whether or not he was a Nazi, we don't know. That's the subject under investigation. And installed in the Pentagon along with him was the top NATO military officer.
And lest these kinds of things seem completely off the wall, and we realize that these are rather strange and bizarre circumstances to contemplate, again, bear in mind, those of you who are longtime listeners know this stuff, those of you who are relatively recent joiners of this particular type of work, that we have talked in the past a great length about the Galen organization itself, and Brigadier General Reinhard Galen, who was Hitler's spy chief for Eastern Europe, almost undoubtedly the most important intelligence officer in Nazi Germany, who jumped to the United States with his entire organization, including a large amount of them who were guilty of various war crimes, were sort of pardoned and dragged out of the dockets en masse and put to work for the United States and then nascent CIA as our Eastern European intelligence force. So this is like an entire organization, a Nazi organization that was grafted on. So when we talk about these other people and suggest the possibility, like like Fritz Kramer that he was brought over and turned, as it were. It's not quite so unusual in the light of the things that are already known about the Gulen organization, Klaus Barbie and Josef Mengele and others. Okay, again, reading from American Swastika by Charles Higham, talking about General Adolf Ernst Heusinger. A colonel in 1938, he was appointed by Hitler chief of the Army High Command Operations Division in 1940. He classically represented that group which sought the continuing power of Germany as a world force and who retained a vision of the hegemony of the Third Reich on the international scene. He fostered the mythology of independence of Hitler and the Nazi Party, thus protecting himself if the Third Reich collapsed, while at the same time serving Hitler well and indeed being directly under his control. He was placed in charge of Operation Sea Lion, the proposed invasion of England plan, which called for a landing of 250,000 German troops in southeastern England and the rapid seizure of London. Heusinger was to be responsible to Colonel General Halder, chief of the German General Staff, who was the choice of the Princess Stephanie Hohenlohe to bring about a negotiated peace in 1940. By World War II, Heusinger was at the highest level of the German General Staff. By 1944, he was very much in unofficial charge of the extraordinary Gulen operation. Bear that in mind. At the end of the war, he skillfully turned coat and emerged unscathed from the early interrogatory stages of the Nuremberg war crime trials. He provoked the contempt of Goering, among others, when he provided the statements needed to add a weight of evidence against the accused. He was cleared as a war criminal and went around calling himself, quote, an American consultant, a term later echoed by the State Department in importing him to the United States. Although he was frequently listed as one of those who planned the abortive assassination of Hitler in 1944, he was in fact one of the few who stood by the Führer in his hour of need. He knew of Hitler's lust for power, and it is estimated that he was responsible for liquidating some 800,000 Jews on the Eastern Front under Hitler's personal instruction. Colonel General Jodl, his immediate superior, was hanged for those crimes on October 16, 1946, and Heusinger went free. He was lucky that, like Schellenberg, he was on the second rung of power and virtually unknown. When Heusinger was released in 1948, he was part of the Bureau Gulen. His old subordinate had given him a job even when he was still in prison. During a mere 2 years in jail, he was able to be a useful Nazi contact, like Skorzeny, that's Otto Skorzeny, otherwise known as Hitler's commando, in Dachau. Gulen, following 13 months of briefing at the War Department, was the first to give Heusinger a real taste of what power in the United States hierarchy might mean. And because Heusinger had a special knowledge of the Russian region, liaising with Schellenberg and using Schellenberg's ITT operation, he would undoubtedly be useful to the Americans. Heusinger spent 3 years with Bureau Gulen. He helped Gulen reconstitute the Gestapo under American cover. He also helped create a new German general staff and encouraged Gulen in setting up the special bureau when Germany became a republic under Adenauer in 1955. Heusinger accepted Adenauer's invitation to plan the new West German army at the same time that Gulen set up his own network. Heusinger reached his apotheosis on April Fool's Day, 1961, when he appeared, resplendent in uniform, as the central figure of a gala occasion. He became the chairman of the Permanent Military Committee of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at an elaborate ceremony in Washington State Department building. President John F. Kennedy, accompanied by General L.L. Lemnitzer, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Admiral of the Fleet Earl Mountbatten, opened the meeting.
Okay, again, as you consider not only the American intelligence agents mustering out of the Army and into CUSA in Dallas for the assassination, as you consider the troops being airlifted first from Texas to Germany and then in the air, armed and ready, over the United States on their way to Texas again as President Kennedy is being killed, remember that we're going to come back to Heusinger in future Radio Free America broadcasts, but Heusinger is in the Pentagon, specifically Suite 1E, and he's in charge of all NATO. He's the top military commander in NATO. That's what Chief of the Central Planning Committee of NATO means. Number one NATO military commander, the top, basically the guy in charge of planning for the U.S. Army in the Pentagon at the same time is Fritz Kramer.
Now, one of the things that we looked at in our Guns of November series about the Kennedy assassination was that Kennedy, and this may sound a little facile to people who didn't hear the program, but it is not only documented, but documented in very weighty and exhaustive fashion, I think it could be said, on Guns of November show number 3. Kennedy, contrary to popular belief, had decided to pull us out of Vietnam, and in fact had his Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and head of military commander in Vietnam, announced that in 1963, as we're going to see. But Kennedy had concluded that we had to get out of Vietnam, and at a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Honolulu in 2 days before he was killed, there was even discussion of an accelerated plan to... Kennedy pushed for an accelerated plan to have the troops withdrawn from Vietnam, or Kennedy's aides did. However, as we looked at in Guns of November show number 3, 2 days after Kennedy was killed, all of his scaling down steps, all of the steps he took to pull us out of Vietnam and scale down the conflict were reversed, and on the day that Kennedy was buried and the day Ruby shot Oswald, basically the course was set for America's involvement in Vietnam. Again, that may seem sort of fantastic to people who didn't hear the program. It may seem a little bit far-fetched, but it is documented in an exhaustive fashion on Guns of November number 3.
And at the end of the broadcast, in about another 10 or 11 minutes, we will tell you where you can get copies if you're interested of those Guns of November tapes.
I'm not even going to attempt to recapitulate the discussion. We haven't got the time, and I haven't got the energy after almost 4 hours of live reading here. But returning, consider this detail now, and again, we're talking about a military coup. MacArthur had been removed by President Truman, Walker had been removed by Kennedy, and the military had expressed great dissatisfaction at being subordinated to civilian authority by the Constitution. Consider the following, then, in light of the reversal of Kennedy's policy arrest after his assassination, reversal of his withdrawal policy, and the subsequent U.S. escalation in Vietnam. Returning again to Forgive My Grief, Volume 4, by Penn Jones. A little section here called The Ambassador on the Payphone. On November 21st, 1963, shortly after lunch Honolulu time, U.S. Ambassador to South Vietnam Henry Cabot Lodge made a long-distance call from the lobby of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. Picture, if you will, this distinguished diplomat with access to phones in the privacy of his room or military circuits at no cost. Yet he was seen, according to the Honolulu Star Bulletin, with a stack of quarters in his hand putting coin after coin into a payphone. Mr. Lodge was in Honolulu for a 9-hour summit conference on Vietnam with Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Financial Aid Chief David E. Bell, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Maxwell D. Taylor, Admiral Harry D. Felt, and General Paul D. Harkins, then Commander of U.S. Forces in Vietnam. Lodge was the only person of the 7-member policymaking body to stay at the Royal Hawaiian. Others slept in military quarters. This group of high-level political and military policymakers had just decided to step up military operations against communist insurgents in Vietnam. This decision was in direct conflict with President Kennedy's announced intention of October 1963 to withdraw 1,000 U.S. military personnel from South Vietnam, reducing the U.S. troop strength there to approximately 14,500. In early June of 1963, President Kennedy required McNamara and Taylor to announce from the steps of the White House that all American forces would be withdrawn from Vietnam by 1965. This statement was in direct opposition with the thrust of the Pentagon and CIA toward deeper involvement in the Vietnam War. The eulogy for President Kennedy had just been conducted in the Capitol Rotunda when the new president, Johnson, met with Lodge and instructed him to return to Vietnam and inform the Saigon government that the U.S. was now going to give South Vietnam strong military support.
Okay, and one last little bit on the subject of some strange maneuverings around the time of the Kennedy assassination, and also having to do with the Vietnamese situation. Here's another section again from Coincidence or Conspiracy by Bernard Fensterwald, which we read from earlier. This is a short segment on Madame Nu, N-H-U, Madame Nu. Madame Nu, widow of Ngo Dinh Nu, is one of the potential mystery figures in any reinvestigation of the Dallas murder, meaning, of course, the Kennedy murder. Although her brother-in-law, Ngo Dinh Diem, was the premier of South Vietnam in 1963, her husband was the power behind the throne, and she is said to have been the power behind her husband. She was an active and powerful force in Vietnamese politics, where both her husband and his brother were assassinated on November 1, 1963. There were loud rumors, which persist to this day, that the CIA was involved in both the coup and the assassinations. The Senate Intelligence Committee concluded in November of 1975 that CIA officials had been involved in the Diem overthrow. Madam New herself placed the, quote, personal blame for the coup on President Kennedy. After the twin killings in Saigon on November 1, 1963, Madam New did not join her children and family in Paris as expected. Surprisingly, she went to the United States. And even more startling, she went to Texas, even to Dallas, all before November 22nd. The details and purpose of her strange trip are a mystery. They might, however, bear some investigation, if for no other reason than to clear up the mystery. Okay, so while we think about the possibilities of military coups and the military's introduction of itself into civilian life and events beginning clear back in the 1930s leading up to the assassination of John F. Kennedy and beyond, because as we mentioned, Albert Wiedemeyer was made a military advisor for Ronald Reagan, there's a lot of things to think about here, and Dave is going to read you one more time some pertinent words that MacArthur had to say about civilian control of the military, and then we're going to take a quick musical break and come back to wrap up and tell you some things about upcoming broadcasts and things of that nature.
Again, from his 1952 address to the Massachusetts legislature, MacArthur spoke as follows. Men of significant stature in national affairs appear to cower before the threat of reprisal if the truth be expressed in criticism of those in higher public authority. For example, I find in existence a new and heretofore unknown and dangerous concept that the members of our armed forces owe primary allegiance and loyalty to those who temporarily exercise the authority of the executive branch of government rather than to the country and its constitution which they are sworn to defend. No proposition could be more dangerous. None could cast greater doubt upon the integrity of the armed services.